Step back, and I have no time for that.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing.
On.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Good evening and welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We're 5 days into the month of December and we're broadcasting live from an unceded and Anishinaabe territory. You are tuned into The Avalanche, a special presentation of CKUT's Community News Department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. Kev here with you and I'm in studio with Gary Anzo, and to top off the hour, some current community listings followed by an interview with John and Christine, two blind Montreal residents who discussed their experience navigating the city and using transportation. Then the final portion of Leah Lashmi's talk in collaboration with Chai Chats. All that right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. You're listening to The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you'd like to get involved, call 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or news at ckut.ca.
This hour, some community events and listings. Youth of Future, YTF, is now recruiting participants for its fifth cohort. YTF is a partnership between the Canadian Council of Rehabilitation and Work and the Disabled Women's Network Canada. Youth of Future Montreal is a program for young women who self-identify as having a disability. This program offers participants a 5-week, 7 hours a day prepaid employment training program, followed by a 10-week paid work placement. During this period, YTF staff will support both the participants and their employers. To be eligible for this program, participants must be committed to securing employment, be a Canadian citizen, a permanent resident, or have refugee status in Canada, have a social insurance number, a SIN card, not be receiving employment insurance, EI benefits, though social assistance poses no problem, be between 15 to 30 years of age, be available for a 6-week in-class pre-employment training program, which is 7 hours a day, be available to work a minimum of 25 hours per week throughout the 10-week work placement. Should you have any questions or are not sure if the program is a good fit for you or someone else, please contact Anna Paz Arellano at 514-669-2349 or by email through aarellano@ccrw.org or Lord Denis Jean at 514-669-2307 or email at ljean@ccrw. Interviews for this program are currently being conducted, and if you feel that you would benefit from this program, please don't hesitate to ask questions and apply. As someone who's done the program, I can attest that it's tremendous help in developing employability skills and supporting you with resources and finding a job. The program can also help with the search and retention of employment, which include, but are not limited to, accommodations, transport, and healthcare. With this program, I was able to find a job I love in a sector I love, and it would not have been without the tremendous support and constant knowledge provided to me. The new cohort starts in January, so apply now. Again, you can find information through 514-669-2349 or 514-669-2307, or you can check out the Dawn Canada's Facebook page for more information.
Thanks, so. The City of Montreal still wants your opinion, although the public consultations are over. You can still influence Montreal's action plan on universal accessibility if you go to makingmtl.ca. You can click on the tab that says online survey. This survey is a great way for you to tell the city officials what you think about accessibility in Montreal. Again, that's www.makingmtl.ca.
As announced last week, the past Monday was International Day of Persons with Disabilities. As mentioned last week, Le Mouvement PASS hosted a demonstration against austerity and the unreasonably long waiting times for services, which particularly affects people with disabilities. CKUT covered the event and will be playing our footage on that on a future date, so stay tuned for that.
If you are a disabled woman and want to contribute your creative skills to a publication on the intersection of gender and disability, Living Edges, a disabled women's reader, is now taking submissions for its updated issue. You're invited to submit art, photography, poetry, essays, and articles under 20 pages to Diane Dredger at umanitoba.ca. Spelled out, that's DIANE.DRIEDGER at umanitoba.ca. The deadline is January 1st, 2019. So be sure to apply soon.
OMEDS is offering a brand new innovation program to help improve your existing skills in Outlook World, Excel, and French in an e-learning format that is tailored individually to your needs. Learn at your own pace in our computer lab with the support of an experienced EMSB teacher and practice your newly enhanced skills with an internship experience. If you identify as having mental health challenges or autism spectrum disorders, please take advantage of this unique training program.
Eligibility.
Yeah. Eligibility. There you go. Sorry, folks. Requirements are the following. Be a resident of the Greater Montreal area. Have a basic knowledge of French conversation and basic computer skills. It's a 16-hour week program for 17 weeks, Monday to Thursday, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. and Friday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., January 7th to May 10th, 2019. Internship is a 3.5 days a week. May 13th till June 21st, 2019. This program is made possible with the financial assistance and help provided by Emploi Québec. For more information, contact Natalie Klein at 514-342-0000, extension 342, or fill out the application online.
34222.
Please contact Natalie for this.
Please contact Natalie for this. Our application online for www.ometz.ca.
If you're looking for holiday gifts and want to support disabled young artists, check out Marché Artisanal Montréal this Friday, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at 5945 Cartier in Rosemont. By buying wares such as soaps, leathers, bound journals, wallets, wreaths, and so much more, you are directly supporting Summit School, a Montreal school that provides education and training for people with intellectual disabilities, autism, and or behavioral and emotional disturbances, as well as the artists that directly make the art. You can check them out at the market or order at summitleatherco.com or techflora.com, which is spelled TECCflora.com. Finally, there is an event tomorrow commemorating the Polytechnique Massacre. December 6th is a day of remembrance and action on violence against women. It commemorates the 14 young women murdered in 1989 at École Polytechnique Montréal because they were women, because they were feminist, because they existed. This day is also dedicated to the memory of all women who have been victims of gender-based violence. These forms of violence take different forms, and they are articulated in other systems of oppression, such as colonialism, capitalism, racism, homophobia, and transphobia. The 12 Days of Action Against Violence Against Women Committee invites you to December 6th commemoration, which will take place at lunchtime, noon, to encourage citizen participation. Several activists and organizations will speak at the ceremony. It's so important to stop violence against women and to show commemoration of the horrid acts that occurred so many years ago and are continuing now. We invite everyone to attend this event, share this event, and show up and have your voices heard. The 12 Days of Action Against Women Committee is composed this year of Action Against Women with Disabilities Montreal, the Documentation Center of Adult Education and the Status of Women, the Conseil Québécois LGBT, and the Disabled Women's Network Canada, the Federation of Quebec Women, the Federation of Women's Shelters, the Women's Worlds Foundation, the Women's Voices, the House of Women Who Are Deaf, Native Women's Shelter of Montreal, and various others. The campaign is carried out thanks to a financial contribution from the Secretariat for Women and the RQCALACS. The event is happening tomorrow at Cabot Square from noon to 1 p.m. The nearest civic address is 1235 Rue Lambert, Closet, which is H3H1Z4. Again, it is happening at Cabot Square tomorrow at noon.
Hey, thanks, Zoe. Hey.
Which is also near
Atwater Station.
Atwater Station, which is near the former Montreal Children's Hospital.
Yeah, it's a very relatively accessible location.
Fine. Today's first segment is an interview with Christine Thioret and John Blumstein. They are both blind Montreal residents. They took the time to discuss the experiences navigating pedestrian walkways and public transportation. They also touch on the danger of construction sites and give suggestions on increasing accessibility of sidewalks and crosswalks. That's up right now. Here it is.
All right. Hello, John and Christine. Thanks so much for giving me your time today.
Hi, Ben.
Hi, Ben.
Hey. So first thing I want to ask is, Christine, as a adapted transport user, can you describe the typical process that you have to go through to get a ride?
Some people book it online, but I haven't quite learned how to do that yet, so I do it over the phone. I sometimes do it through the automated system, so I can just, if I have what would you call it, a list of favorites. So if, for instance, going to the MAB or going to one of my doctors or a couple of my friends, they're already in the automated system, so I can just call there without having to go through the whole agent thing. But if I'm going to a new place, I have to call the number, and sometimes you have to wait. You might be told that you're the 130th in the queue, so you have quite a while. So you put it on speaker, and you go ahead and do other things while you're waiting. And then the agent will come on, and he'll tell you, ask you questions about where you're going and what time you want to be there, what time you want to leave there and get back home. And that's basically the procedure.
And in your opinion, what are some of the flaws with the services?
The only flaws I see are, because I've been using it for almost 30 years, since the early 90s I've been using the service, and I didn't use it a lot then, but now I use it many times a week, especially in the winter, because it's so difficult to get around. But there's a lot of waiting around. For instance, this week I was at Walmart with a friend. My pickup should have been at 2:30. To come home, but apparently the driver claims that he came in, didn't see us, and left, and put me down as no-show, which is not great on your file when right. You haven't advised them that you're not there, and that wasn't the truth. So when I called after the 30 minutes that you're allowed to call to say that they were late, they informed me that he had put me down at 2:41 as not there, as absent. So then they said, okay, we'll give you another pickup time. And my next pickup time was 4:10. And each time they give you a time, there's still this 30-minute window where mm-hmm. they can be up to 30 minutes late. And so they picked me up at, 4:45 they picked me up. So we waited from 2:30. Well, we were actually sitting on the bench at 2:15, and we were picked up at 4:45. So that was not pleasant, and thank goodness it doesn't happen very often. But lately, there's been something going on. I think that they must be overloaded with more and more people. I think I was told that they have 10,600 trips they do in a day. So they're trying to fit everybody in, and I have been three people in the back of a car with my guide dog and one person in the front, and it's so crowded. So that is another issue, but generally, I don't know what I'd do without it.
As you mentioned, there's up to 10,000 rides a day, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so do you think that the city should work on improving the adapted transport service and offering more of that service, or should they focus on improving the accessibility of the systems they already have, such as the metro and the bus, or do you think that maybe they can do both at the same time?
I think they need to do both at the same time, just because not all handicapped people use adapted transport, although I would think that more and more people, the majority of people I know right now, are using it. But vans, for instance, most of the vans have just one seat in them, and that's at the back of the van, and it's supposed to have three people or be able to hold three people. But it's ridiculous when they try to put three people, because it's basically meant for just two, and then you are so crowded if you get in the winter, especially three bigger people with the winter coats and everything, you cannot move. Mm-hmm. But for a person with a guide dog, most of the vans don't have carpeting because they have a ramp that they put down for people to get on and off, and the guide dogs slide around much as you're holding on to their leash. They slide around, and a couple of my guide dogs I haven't been able to bring because they ended up, one of my dogs had a knee problem, and she just couldn't take being almost thrown around in the van when the drivers go around a corner really quickly or stop kind of jerkily. And so right. I don't think any of the guide dogs really do well with the vans. It's a bit of a nuisance.
So now I'd like to just move on to some questions regarding the winter weather that is approaching. It is snowing today as well. First off, with Christine using adapted transport, how do you find that the winter weather affects your ability to have timely services, or does it affect the services at all?
The snow, if it's really bad weather, not a day like today, but if we've had a storm, what happens is they often will tell you on the recording that they're not taking any new reservations for the next day. So they will take reservations that have already been booked. So your best bet for people that don't know any better, just book their transport like the day before. But you can book up to 1 week ahead, so you're better to book your stuff ahead, because if the weather gets bad, especially in the winter, you could end up having no opportunity to go to, let's say, a Christmas party. Right. So if you haven't booked your transport and then all of a sudden tomorrow we have a snowstorm, well, then you're not going to get to that Christmas party, and it's kind of your own fault because you haven't booked in advance. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we have no choice, but especially the opportunity to book 1 week in advance for medical appointments and stuff is good. But generally, if I didn't have adapted transport in the winter, I probably wouldn't go even to half of the places that I go to in the winter now, because I have a problem with both my knees at the moment, and so walking in bad weather on a lot of snow, climbing snow banks, and walking on icy sidewalks is really difficult. So if I didn't have transport, I don't know what I'd do. Mm-hmm. I probably would be staying in an awful lot. But it does, the winter makes it's very difficult for getting around, even with a guide dog, because you got to climb snowbanks. And last winter, the ice was so bad, even my dog fell on the ice a couple of times. So, but, you know, we still have to get out, although I'm finding I'm not walking him anywhere near as much as I used to. We're getting out to do his business and doing my activities that I have to do, but he is not getting the walking exercise that we normally would do.
Now, something that I'm sure both of you could speak to. So in the winter, what particular ways does the city itself become harder to navigate as a person who uses a guide dog or is blind?
Well, the construction doesn't help, mm-hmm. because not only are you worrying about the ice, which, you know, Chris said, it becomes slippery and makes it more difficult to walk. And as I was saying, blind people have sometimes balance issues, so therefore it compounds it. But there's also the constant construction, you know, holes in the sidewalk or barriers or and they aren't always properly indicated for a blind person anyway. They have signs that are at eye level, which you miss and bash into you with your face, or they have little ones that are smaller, which you'll end up getting you in the groin area if you aren't careful when you're walking. And for me, anyway, because I don't have a guide dog, it can be disorienting when you're walking along and you think you've got your route pretty much set up, and you come across a whole pile of signs, and then you don't know where you're going to end up at the end of them. So that's not just a winter thing, of course. It also happens in the winter compounds it, because if there is a snowfall, everything's white. I have a bit of vision, but not much depth vision, so that therefore I can't tell whether that white in front of me is a big pile of snow or just a normal layer of snow on the road. So,
right.
And sometimes the plowing will suddenly just come to a stop. I've been actually walking along on a clear sidewalk and then toppled over a snowbank where they just stopped. And you don't know it until you're actually doing a somersault in the air, because there's this mountain of very hard snow which they've left. And that's something which, you know, is just inconsiderate. And you don't want to go too far out of your way, because then there is the ice issues, and of course there's traffic issues.
One thing that's we haven't mentioned that's really important is the fact that the drivers of the snow plows and the little things that come on the sidewalk are absolutely scary for people like us, because we don't know which way they're going. Mm-hmm. And apparently they have so many blind spots that they don't see us. And so what are we supposed to do? If I, for instance, have to take my dog out at night, especially even just to do his business, and if I hear trucks out there, I will wait till those trucks have gone by, because I don't know where they're going to go. And if they can't see me and I can't see them, we're in for big trouble.
Yeah, mm-hmm. An unidentified sound that's moving is a real danger signal for any blind person. With or without, like, I've got partial vision and it still scares me. You hear the motor and you're going, okay, is he coming up this side of the street, that side of the street? Is he going to pivot? Because those little army tank snow plows can pivot just like that. I've watched them when I'm closer. And that is scary, because if they hit you even a glancing blow, you're in serious trouble.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's I've never been hit by one, but I've been close.
Yeah, I find those sidewalk snowplows are very aggressive.
Yes,
they are.
Yes,
I think they want to plow us down.
Yeah. I've actually had to jump in a snowbank because I do have some vision.
Me too. I had to do it once.
And I've seen them, and I thought, this guy's not stopping. I could, you know, I could judge enough of the distance. So I jumped into the snowbank, and it was like, whoa.
Yeah, I went over a fence one time because of it.
Yeah.
This is like years ago when I lived on Madison, and it was just a little fence. But I was glad I knew that that fence was there, and I could get over it and get into my front yard because I was terrified of that thing.
They don't always let you know what they're going to do. Although I must admit, recently there have been a lot more people at construction sites, and a person will walk up to me and say, we're digging here, can I walk you around this? Which is good. I must admit, sometimes they're actually overly helpful because I just need to go around the barrier and back on the road, and they're walking with you. But I'd rather have them overprotect than underprotect. So
of course.
That's good.
Going off of that, barring someone kind of going out of their way to alert you to the construction or guide you around it, are there any ways that you think signage could be more accessible or more informative for a blind person?
I don't know about signage because it's a visual thing. I think what they should do, though, is make a standard place for them to be. For example, if they're going to put them on the... we've always found, I don't know about Chris, but I've always found it amusing that they put the no parking signs for cars on the sidewalk.
Right.
So that the cars can still park and not be disrupted, but your pedestrians are banging into them all the time. If they're going to have to do that for whatever reason, put them in the same place on the edge of the curb or whatever, or if they're going to put them against the verge, you know, where the grass is or whatever it happens, then put them there so that once a blind person identifies the first one, they could then know they have to be careful after that. But often they just put them randomly. They're in the middle, they're on either side.
Yeah.
Some are turned in a different direction. And, of course, the wind blows them over, so you can trip over them after that because they just, you know, there's way too much lack of consideration about that. I don't think there's anything they can do about making them more accessible because once you bumped into a sign, you know what it is.
Well, you can imagine walking down the street, and I'm fortunate to have a guide dog that John does. Doesn't have, so he has to have the stress of looking or trying to look at whatever is ahead of him. At least my dog does that for me. But you can imagine if you're going out and you have these signs that he's talking about on the sidewalk, plus the garbage, plus the recycling. And it's just ridiculous. You can't get anywhere on the sidewalk. Your dogs are going around stuff constantly. It's just ridiculous sometimes. Yeah.
I feel like there's no standard set in place for smaller signage or like warnings or something you can feel while you're walking leading up to construction zones. Like they'll just put the sign and be like, okay, it starts now.
That's right. There's no, and the barriers themselves are all different. I guess the best one would be when they put up a whole fence. You know, they actually raise a fence around the hole. That is probably the most effective.
Okay.
But sometimes it's a tape. And I've actually gone into holes because the tape, you feel it, but by that point it's giving.
Your feet are in it.
And your feet are already practically in it, and you have a choice of either falling backwards or forwards, and the tape is stopping you, so you're almost like doubling over the tape. It might be very visual. I don't know, because I can't see that well, but it's stupid as an indicator of a barrier.
Because we know someone who fell in a 4-foot hole just a few weeks ago, and luckily for him was not hurt.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He fell in it just the same, and there were people that were there around, but they I guess didn't get to him fast enough. The people were not right by the hole to stop that accident from happening.
Or the barrier is only up partially. In other words, you might have a barrier on the sidewalk at the beginning of it, but you don't know how long the hole's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't always have barriers on the sides of the hole so that you're walking wondering, well, am I going to be stepping in? Because you don't always walk straight. I mean, I don't. I try to, but you can't always tell if you're veering from one side to another. And I've actually fallen into holes, although not seriously, because I thought I had already gotten around it and it was still there. They just hadn't bothered marking it.
Well, that's the advantage of having a guide dog,
because it also helps you to
walk straight down the sidewalk, and the dog will stay straight on the sidewalk except for when he has to veer around either people or obstacles, so and go back on that straight line once he's been around that obstacle.
Mm-hmm.
So for that,
guide dogs
are, as long as they follow their dog and you know, pay attention to what the dog is trying to teach them.
Yeah. I mean, this is also for elderly people, too,
yep.
Not just, you know,
exactly.
who have got vision, but are just get disoriented when they come across a big thing. It's hard to take in. I've got a fair amount. I mean, I'm losing vision now, and I've always been blind, but I had more vision before. And because of that, I have a sense of what things are, because I've experienced them visually before I lost the vision. So I know sort of what to think about. But for a person it's never happened to, it's a whole different kettle of fish.
Obviously, there are tons of issues with construction around this city.
Yeah.
But, like, in general, prioritizing a project over pedestrians trying to navigate the city is just ridiculous in my mind.
And yeah. I really think, like we said earlier, that they need to have more people on site, somebody who's, you know, overlooking the whole thing,
mm-hmm.
That at least can be able to help people get around, whether they be visually impaired yeah. or other handicaps or
right.
the elderly, because there's
yeah.
a lot of elderly people out
they
there.
They have the same issues. Yeah.
And they don't even know they have a visual problem.
Yeah.
You know, we all know that, and mm-hmm. we know how to deal with it because we've been living with it most of our life.
Yeah.
But elderly people don't even realize how much... how much vision they don't have, or how they're not able to make decisions correctly to get around
fast,
things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
One practice the city does, which they do, by the way, with leaves and they do it with snow, is that they've cleared an area on a sidewalk, but when you get to the intersection, the snowbank's been piled up there, or the pile of leaves have been left there. And
right.
They aren't small. Some of them are huge.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're walking along, and you're on the proper course, but then you come across this mountain of debris, and you don't know, okay, do I go right or left? Do I go out into traffic? And even then, that's difficult, because they've already got a bank of snow from the plowing. So you're going to have to go through a snowbank of one kind or another, or walk all the way back to the end of the block and then walk out on the street to avoid it. Because and that's dangerous for a person with navigation issues, no matter whether they're old or blind or whatever, because you are trying to gauge how much climbing you're going to have to do or how much back walking you're going to have to do.
Right.
And you don't know. Can take you 20 minutes to figure out a block.
So I feel like there are some systemic things we could change in maybe construction policy or just how the city navigates the clearing of snow and the clearing of leaves. But until those things happen, because there's, you know, political process and a lot of junk,
mm-hmm.
junk that goes on along with that, what are some things that you would suggest that the average homeowner or apartment owner could do to, you know, make their part of the sidewalk more accessible?
If they're going to shovel their walk, which is perfectly understandable, shovel it completely onto the street. Don't make a little mountain on either side of the pathway, which
mm-hmm.
people were doing. And until the law was changed, a lot of people still do. They have a plow come in to do their driveway, but rather than clearing the snow completely, he leaves a mountain of snow on both sides at the sidewalk level. So you're walking along, and it's this huge mountain of snow, and then over it there's a clean driveway, and then over that there's another mountain of snow, and then you're fine again. I've actually gone into people's houses and banged on their doors and said, you know, you're responsible for cleaning that off. Because I was tripping all the time, because, again, your depth perception doesn't tell you. You're thinking, and if there's a white covering of snow anyway, you don't know whether that white covering's the flat bit of covering or with a big mountain. And so I've actually gone into people's houses and said, excuse me, your contractor should be clearing that off all the way. And he says, well, that's the contractor. I said, no, it's your address, and that's where I'm going to be sending it to.
Right.
And then you'll get the fine.
Right.
I said, clean it. You know, it only takes another 5 seconds. You know, it's not exactly a big problem, but it's easily fixed.
That's a good point, that it's so easy to just do that one extra step.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like money intensive, and the same with what I was saying about the signs. Make a standard deployment of your signage and stick to it, and then people, including blind people who are not stupid, will figure out the connection of where they are and what they're going to be in the because I know that if I come across a no parking sign, I know I'm coming up against construction. I don't
mm-hmm.
know when it's going to come up, and I don't know where the other signs are going to be, but if they put them all in the same place, I know, okay, I'm coming into this area, the right side's full of signs, stay to the left, and be careful. But, you know, you have to slalom them all over the place to get through it. That, I think, the biggest thing is, I mean, everything else the city has problems with it for everybody, like icing, salting the streets properly, and all that kind of stuff. blind people find big puddles of water and mountains of leaves very, very distracting, because you don't know what you step around the mountain of leaves and then you're in a lake.
No, absolutely.
I had a guide dog that refused to go over those mounds of leaves at the corners of streets when I used to go to the Y, and it was quite an interesting trip to try to get there, because he refused to walk through it.
Yeah.
It was an obstacle to him, and he did not want to go through it. And he didn't see a way of going around it without taking me into busy traffic.
Yeah. And I take boots. I mean, people say, what are you wearing those boots for? I said, because I don't know when I'm going to be up to 3 feet of water. And I said, I don't want a pair of good shoes on because I'm going to get soaking wet. I said, but when I come across an obstacle, I have to go left or right, and I don't know what's on either side. Mm-hmm. I said, so if I'm going to splash through water, I want to be prepared if I can be anyway.
Is there anything else that you two would like to add? Around the topics of accessibility, navigating the city, winter?
The only thing is a general question, a general thing I think they should be doing more of, because they aren't that expensive compared to some of these mega projects they get going. There should be more what they call talking or chatting lights throughout the city. I think it could save a lot of lives. I know that there's more now than there ever used to be, which I find helpful, but they aren't always in great places. I mean, for example, at Cavendish and Sherbrooke, they've got two, but you can't. One is for north and one is for east-west. You can't do both. You have to cross, to do it properly, you actually have to cross an unbeeped thing to get to the other side. So, for example, if I'm walking north on Cavendish from my place, I have to cross normally, like any other person does, and then get to the button that goes east-west on the north side of the street. I don't understand why they've made it so that, because with drivers texting now and doing other things like that, I don't know how Chris does it, because I can see a bit, and I can see when some driver is just doing all kinds of crazy things. And I hope her dog's watching, because I have seen things that make your hair raise up on your end, thinking, wow. The chatting light, I think, would give a more indication of when you really can go and when not to.
Right.
And they've changed the light sequences. Westmount's got this new four-way thing. But a blind person doesn't know that. It's green for four ways for pedestrians. But they don't know that. They go by sound. And the traffic patterns are going north-south, and they want to go east. They don't realize that.
So they definitely need more audible signals. It's because here at the corner of Sherbrooke and Cavendish, where both of us live, they've decided that it costs too much money, so we've only got two. Instead of them being good for four corners, they're only good for two corners. So crossing north to south on the west side, there isn't one.
Yeah.
But there is one going north-south on the east side. And nobody wants to cross on that particular side, because the traffic turns in every which way that's going down towards St. Jacques Street. So it's terribly, terribly, terribly dangerous.
We don't know why they don't put more in. As I said, it's relatively cheap.
It's cost.
It's cost. But it's funny, if someone actually got killed there, then there'd be a big thing about, but I don't want to be the sacrificial goat that gets hit.
No.
Because I was already hit crossing Cavendish, and the car just ignored the light and turned anyway. So you want any aid that'll help you a bit. It won't stop the problem completely, because drivers disobey the rules all the time, but at least you know you're out there correctly.
Obviously, they can't put audible signals everywhere in the city, but major
intersections should have them. Any kind
like
of major.
Sherbrooke and Cavendish, DeCary and Sherbrooke and other things like that. It's just, especially where there's a lot of traffic where people go. I mean, there's a Provigo and a Pharmaprix right on our corner here, so everybody goes here, you know, that are pedestrians, and then the cars are, like, so many cars. There's very few pedestrians that you meet that can help you, because there's not a lot of pedestrian traffic there.
Well, I agree. They should be all over downtown where there's a lot of pedestrians and a lot of cars at the same time. Like, there's no reason they shouldn't be everywhere.
That would be the biggest thing. If we could push for something, would be for more audible signals.
Well, if they can light up the Jacques-Cartier Bridge, which I think was a great gesture, but the point is that where does a city decide that the safety of their citizens is more important than looking good all the time? I mean,
for sure.
You know, what is a life worth? And this is what always amazes me, is that the common sense approach to a lot of problems gets sidetracked or pushed off because, oh, it's too much money for $30 to put in there, as opposed to spending billions of dollars on something which is great, nothing against it, but if you've got money for that, then you should be saying we've got to put more things up for safety.
So we've talked about audible lights, putting better fencing and signage around construction, and folks really making sure that their part of the sidewalk is clear to work together to improve accessibility for blind folks or people using guide dogs. So thank you so much for your time and for sharing your experiences. I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
No, you're very welcome. Have a great day.
Have a good day.
Take care.
Hey, welcome back to the Avalanche. You were just listening to an interview with John Blumstein and Christine Theria about the problems encountered when you're traveling through the city with either walking or using the transport adapté.
For today's second feature, we will be playing our final part of our coverage from the Leah Lakshmi Pepsina Samarasingha event, hosted by Chai Chats. The event included a reading of excerpts of Leah's new book, Care Work, which maps access as radical love and celebrates the work that sick and disabled QT BIPOCs do to build power and create radically resilient, sustainable communities of liberation where no one is left behind. The event was hosted by Chai Chats and included a reading of the book by Leah and a discussion of the book. CKUT's The Avalanche was proud to cover this event. You can support Care Work by ordering a copy on the publisher Arsenal Pulp Press's website through your local independent bookstore. We personally recommend Racine's in Montreal Nord, located on 4689 Boulevard Henri Bourassa Est, or by ordering a copy through your local library. You can check out Chai Chats' podcast to listen to the rest of this by looking them up on iTunes or SoundCloud. If you would like to support the work that they do on the podcast, consider donating to their Patreon on patreon.com/chaichats. That's up now.
If you've experienced trauma, the sort of black and white thinking that shows up a lot in my life is a product of living trauma and just seeking safety and desperately seeking like who's good and who's bad and who's safe and who's unsafe. And in my experience, that's just never ended well.
Yeah.
Because everyone that I'm in relationship with eventually is going to fall off the pedestal, and then I'm sort of left with this villainized narrative of them, and I'm often finding myself running and trying to get back to who's the good guys.
Yeah.
And there just aren't any in that one-dimensional, flattened character kind of way in my life and in my experience. And so being with the complexity of everyone's shadow self showing up at some point or another in my relationships with them has been a really terrifying experience. And to kind of also link it to accountability, it's also been really terrifying and beautiful to find people safe enough to let that trauma out with. And finding that actually is a really scary thing, because maybe for the first time in my life, and I don't know if others resonate with this, but being in relationship with someone, on the one hand feeling safe enough to let my shadow self out with, can also be a really awful thing, because now all of the previous times where I couldn't let that out are going to show up now. And what the fuck do I do with that? Because this person in front of me who has triggered or brought out, you know, this trauma is actually not responsible for the accountabilities of the past. And that's shown up in my life, and I think has shown up in, you know, the lives of the folks that we're in relationship with and we've talked about. And that's a terrifying thing, and also beautiful in the sense that, wow, I found somebody safe enough that I can do that grieving work. And that's something that shows up in the book a lot as well, is this process of grief.
Oh, well, I was going to respond to something previous, but it's kind of, yeah, sure.
Yeah, just the, and then the, like, the interplay, because so much of this is in the dynamic, right? And so, like for me, that panic response of, like, oh my God, let me own all the things, and, like, being in situations where, like, I was taking accountability for like a whole host of things before I even knew what I was taking accountability for, and some were like completely legitimate and that I was like grateful to have exposed, and then others were just like misunderstandings of something that I didn't even do, but I just immediately was like, I know I'm bad, let's start this, you know, and just like the slowing down to even be able to like really talk about like what exactly is, you know, going on when that urgency and stuff comes up. So it's like the dynamic between the two as well.
And then I think after this, you can have it's your like final total responses, super response. but
when
you
are
know,
we supposed to be over by?
Well, we're going to have Q&A after this.
Oh.
So like Matt for half an hour. Gotcha. And then, yeah, yeah. But just to kind of tie everything together in terms of like just be accountability and just the fear that we experience not only in approaching our own traumas, but also just within the social justice scene. And, you know, the quote that you had with like care work being like permaculture, I was kind of thinking a lot about how I feel like the social justice scene is really a monoculture. You know, it's very, there's a very particular structure of thinking, of behaving, of responding, of, there's a level of institutionalized, you know, justice rhetoric in there that doesn't necessarily have space for healing or transformative or restorative justice that we're talking about now. And, you know, you talk about care work being like permaculture in the sense of like how I think about it is like holistic systems design, you know, like diversifying your femme emotional labor portfolio, right? And like not only just like going to the same person to dump on or the the same things that you're doing, but we really have to really be able to open up to many forms of healing and to many shapes and forms of healing for us to be able to carry each other in a way that is sustainable. And I feel like with the social justice world, you know, and maybe some of y'all will resonate with this out there, but it's exhausting. It's extremely exhausting because you're consistently, you know, policing yourself. And even when you do, well, someone's going to call you out because you fucked up, you know, in some shape or form. And there's a monoculture way of dealing with that. There's a monoculture within accountability and what justice actually really looks like. Well, justice looks like a lot of different things for a lot of different people. And same with liberation. And I just kind of wanted to say, like, you know, you were talking about justice before, and this is a quote that I loved. The quote is by Cornel West. Justice is what love looks like in public. And I just felt like that just really was just so beautiful and just bringing together, just remembering our humanity. I think that identity politics in many ways has dehumanized us, you know, and has allowed us to be treated in certain ways that we would never treat people like, or that we shouldn't be treating people in this way. You know, I think identity politics does create certain levels of hierarchies and pedestals, like you say, where we can be knocked on or off or put up or down. And and that's really exhausting, that movement of puppeteering almost, that you're not even really in control of all the time, is exhausting. So I just wanted to say, yeah, justice is what love looks like in public.
Yeah, first of all, I want to say, like, that's really, Donna, that's interesting. I'm like, I don't know if I agree. Like, I think it's different living in the United States because, like, right now in the United States, like, fascists are using the word identity politics as a swear word against Black and brown people organizing and queer and trans people. So for me, I'm like, when I hear that, I'm like, no, our identities are important. Like, I want that. I mean, I think I get what you're saying, but I'm just like, oh, no, like, I don't want to abandon that, you know? And then, like, I think it's important to be like, those words can mean so many different things in different spaces. And then I'd forgotten I put that quote in there. I'm like, oh yeah, that sounds good. And I guess hearing it, I'm like, that sounds cute. But I feel like listening to it, I'm like, I feel like a lot of people might be like, that's great. What does it mean? And I guess that leads me to like something I was thinking, excuse me, when you were speaking, Parneet, which is that like, you know, like those, like, I feel like I've been seeing since I was in my 20s, you know, like in coming to radical movement, being like, I want a safe home. I want to find shit that's safe. And I think a lot of us do that. We're just like, I want to be in a place that's not fucked up, you know? And then we run right in. And then, you know, like we run into things like, wait, no, that person's fucked up and that person's fucked up and I'm fucked up and you're fucked up. And sometimes we end up with like two people as friends, you know, like both because sometimes like we do have identities that few people are holding safe. So it makes sense. And also sometimes because we're just like, ah, shit, I feel like we're really in deep places of betrayal, you know? And we have really deep needs to be like, fuck, like, my heart just got broken. I thought that you knew how to love me, you know? I don't know. I mean, I think that for me, I guess like one thing, so this is the thing, Parnit, when you were talking, I was resonating with everything you were saying. And it was also making me think about how I see this dichotomy sometimes in communities where people, I feel like there's like some people who are like, well, hurt people, and we've all been hurt, so everybody hurts each other and no one's safe. So that's just how it is. And that's not enough for me, you know? And we're just kind of like, we gotta all fuck each other over, so whatever, that's just what it is. And then you've got people on the other side being like, if you scratch your ass wrong one time, that's it. We're going to throw you off the island. And I want something in the middle where it's just like, actually, like, yeah, like we all have the ability to cause harm and be harmed. And if I cause harm, I want there to be consequences. I don't want to be thrown off the island. But it's totally fair and okay for someone to be like, hey, dude, like, I'm not feeling good about that. And like, I need you to do X, Y, and Z. Or I don't know what I need, but I need you to just hear that I'm mad. And I think that it's, you know, I want, like, I've been having a lot of conversations with people where they're like, yeah, like, there's a difference between consequence and actually locking somebody up, you know? Like, and it's okay for there to be consequences when we hurt each other. And it'd be cool if those consequences can also maybe have, like, an expiry date or, like, a, like, you know, you're not canceled forever. Like, I can be mad and I can want change and also we're in this together, you know? So I guess I'm thinking a lot about that and still figuring it out, and I don't have all the fucking answers at all, but, you know, thinking about that, what else am I thinking about? Wait, this is the meta answer. Just that I think that one place, like tying it back to disability justice, I think that one of the many places that I think as disabled people, we have a lot of gifts that we can offer to ourselves and to abled people is this understanding that like perfection are not the goal, that like DJ's really messy, like, you know, our body minds are really messy, and that doesn't mean they're wrong, and that we can be in messy movements and still be figuring it out and be making a lot of mistakes, and that there's value to that, you know, there's value to that. And I think that that's, I don't know, there's a whole schmear I see now where like everyone's like constant, I mean the last 2 years in particular have had like this post-Trump panic attack, and I think we were reactive before. I think I see a lot of us being more reactive now and really struggling. I mean, my first year after Trump, I was like, shit, my anxiety's way up. Like, my panic attacks are 3 days long, and it's for real reasons, you know? And then everyone else's panic attacks are 3 days long, and then we're all, it's like trigger ping pong, you know? It's like a really fucked up pinball game. We're all like, ah! And the heat's really turned up. So then I think some of the questions are like, it's a disabled knowledge base or disabled questioning to be like, how do we, what's the best way to hold this? Like, how do we like acknowledge that we're all anxious as hell and we're all triggered as hell and we're still trying to like make home and family and communities and like not die?
So with the book, one of the things I really, really appreciated, and I alluded to it a little bit in the beginning when we were talking, was this idea of taking things slow. Things are going to be fucked up. They're not going to be easy. They're going to be messy. But just like that idea of organizing around slowness when there is a world that, like, you know, perpetuates this, like, having to go fast and having to do things in urgency. So how to reconciliate sort of the slowness and, like, almost elevate the slowness. I don't know if that makes sense, but yeah, that's kind of the question I had.
How to be slow?
Yes.
Yeah, that's such a great question. Thank you for asking it. I don't know. The first thing that came to mind was like, it's hard. And then I'm like, I don't think it is. I think that like, we have to kind of scrape away layers of gunk that have been put on us. But like, actually, it's pretty normal, you know, or not normal, like, it's within reach. I don't know. I mean, I feel like there's a lot of decolonizing ableism, like racialized ableism that has to happen, because I mean, it's so many things, but like there's this banging gong that never stops. It's like, you got to do it this way. You got to do it this fast. Oh my God. And then there's the layers where our communities are under attack. And there's just this feeling of like, I have to respond. I have to do this. What do you mean slow? And I don't know. I mean, maybe the best way I can reply is like how I've done it. Like I don't have the answer, you know, but like, I feel like for me, I don't think I would have learned slow unless I was pushed into it by having chronic fatigue, you know? Like, I didn't have a choice, and I did have choices, like, go way beyond my capacity and then just be, like, sick for 2 months. And I did that for 9 million years, and I still do that, you know, because life. But I think what happened for me was, like, you know, being able to like slowly, you know, meet like one or two at first other sick and disabled cutie BIPOC and be like, let's have a meeting at your house. Or, you know, the million times that I was like, I'm sorry, I'm late. And they were like, hey, that's okay. Like, why don't we just like, I'll just make some food and you come over when you come over. I mean, being part of organizing projects, like in Seattle, we did a benefit for Aurora Levens Morales, who's a really amazing Puerto Rican and Ashkenazi Jewish disabled elder called Kindling Love. And everybody involved was disabled. And we had all these meetings leading up to the benefit where like an hour before, 90% of everyone who was coming would cancel. Like, we'd go, sorry, can't make it, sorry. And so then like we did the conference call, and also at the end, like, we organized most of the event in like the 10 days before the benefit, you know? And then we were like, oh, maybe this is just a way, this is a disabled way that we organize, you know? Like, maybe it's a disabled way to organize where, like, I'm not saying that marijuana is the answer to everything. It's not. But man, we really were like, can we just all pass this and like not have some pain for a second? Anyone who wants to, you know, in this community of people who was using it as a tool. And I also want to like very much honor sober communities as like brilliant and resilient and to be in that complexity. But like, that's just one example. I think that there's a lot of examples of really being like, what do we need to be together with each other? You know, and like what, and like maybe to be experimental, be like, if we throw out the banging gong and we move at the speed of what we can do, what can we do? You know, like, and being creative. Like, I mean, I've had meetings in a doorway, you know, I've definitely had meetings on Facebook. And, you know, I mean, I think to Full Circle United, which is a group that my friend Naima and a bunch of other friends who are Black and Indigenous women, many of whom are disabled, in Olympia, Washington, organized after an incident of anti-Black police brutality. And a lot of them were parents, and they were just like, we're just gonna meet really fucking slowly. We're gonna have slow marches. We're gonna have marches where the elders and disabled people are in the front, and we're gonna move really slowly. And we're gonna see, you know, we're gonna see how that changes the work we do. And we're gonna, and it, often it's practicing something we're not used to, because we're so used to like, go, 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 go. Oh God, you know, we don't have time to talk about that. That it's like really like, okay, what if instead of trying to do 40 things, we pick 2 things, you know? And we do it at the rate of our bodies. And I think a lot of that experiment is acknowledging that it's a really tender thing to bring your disabled self or your tired self or your mad self that might be slow to a space where maybe you've, because for so many of us, we've been in spaces where we've been like faking it. We've been like faking that we're as fast as everybody else, right? And that it's really tender, you know? And it can be an experiment that. I think I'm gonna kind of like both and it too, and like one thing that my friend Ajeris was talking about was she's like, you know,
you were just listening to the final part of the Avalanche's coverage of the Leah Lakshmi event hosted by Chai Chats. Remember, you can find the Chai Chats podcast by looking them up on iTunes or SoundCloud. If you would like to support the work they do on the podcast, consider donating to their Patreon on patreon.com/chaichats.
And that completes this episode of The Avalanche, a special edition of Off the Hour, airing every Wednesday from 5 to 6. Thank yous due to all those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. If you'd like more information on anything you've heard tonight, or if you'd like to support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact The Avalanche at avalanche@ckut.ca or CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or news@ckut.ca. Do stay tuned. Hersey's On Deck, and coming up next for the rest of the crew, this is Kevin saying we'll see you in 7. And remember, if you want to survive, don't drink and drive, because we want you back here next time. Kev, out.
Audio Smack on CKUT 90.3. You're listening to Audio Slam on CKT 90.3, gifted with the presence of CA. This evening we are. You're listening to Audio Smut on CKUT 90.3, and this evening we are gifted with the presence of C.A. Conrad, priestess, poet, witch, mage, ritualist, and traveler, who we caught giving a really incredible talk last night at the Writer's Read series at Concordia, and they're here reading some poems and chatting about life and the world and magic.
Thank you so much for having me. So this poem, well, both of the poems that I'm reading for you come from a ritual that I've been doing called Resurrect Extinct Vibration, where I've been looking at the fact that in my lifetime, and I'm in my 50s now, that the planet that we're living on has lost 60% of all of its wild creatures. And what I've been doing is flooding my body with the recordings of these extinct animals wherever I'm at in the United States. My goal is to go to all 50 of the states to do this. I'm pretty much halfway through the lower 48 states at this point, where I lie on the ground on a blanket, and then I have speakers down by my feet, and then I move them slowly up my body while I'm writing. And I didn't know how to imagine this, the feelings I would have. I assumed wrong. I assumed that I would become depressed. But it's the opposite. I'm filled with joy hearing these sounds. And frankly, feeling a little guilty about it. This poem is called On All Fours, I Am a Seat for the Wind. Most of